I didn't remember that happening, but I could understand. Vampire or human, no one wanted to hang around someone drenched in vomit.
Whoa,
I said. I locked eyes with Edith in the reflection. This was strange, too, because the beau in the mirror looked right next to Edith, like he belonged. Not like before, when people could only imagine that she was taking pity on me.
It's a lot, she said.
I took a deep breath and nodded.
Okay.
She pulled on my hand again, and I followed. Before a fourth of a second had passed, we were through the glass doors behind the stairs and on the back lawn. There were no moon and no stars. The clouds were too thick. It should have been pitch black outside the rectangle of light shining through the glass wall, but it wasn't. I could see everything.
Whoa, I said again. That is so cool.
Edith looked at me like she was surprised by my reaction. Had she forgotten what it was like the first time she saw the world through vampire eyes? I thought she'd said I wouldn't forget things anymore.
We're going to have to go a ways out into the woods, she told me. Just in case.
I remembered the gist of what she'd told me about hunting.
Right.
So there aren't any people around. Got it. Again, that same surprised look flashed across her face and then was gone.
Follow me, she said.
She whipped down the lawn so fast that I knew she would have been invisible to my old eyes. Then, at the edge of the river, she launched herself into a high arc that spun her over the river and into the trees beyond.
Really?
I called after her. I heard her laugh.
I promise, it's easy.
Great. I sighed, then started running. Running had never been my forte. I was all right on a flat track, if I was paying enough attention and I kept my eyes on my feet. Okay, honestly, even then I was still able to tangle my feet up and go down. This was so different. I was flying down the lawn, faster than I'd ever moved. But it was only too simple to put my feet exactly where they were supposed to go. I could feel all of my muscles, almost see the connections as they worked together, will them to do exactly what I needed. When I got to the edge of the river, I didn't even pause. I pushed off the same rock she'd used, and then I was really flying. The river slipped away behind me as I rocketed through the air. I passed where she'd landed and then fell down into the wood. I felt an instant of panic when I realized I hadn't even considered the landing. But then my hand already seemed to know how to catch a thick branch and angle my body so that my feet hit the ground with barely a sound.
Holy crow!
I breathed in total disbelief. I heard Edith running through the trees, and already her gait was as familiar to me as the sound of my own breathing. I was sure I could tell the difference between the sound of her footfalls and anyone else's.
We have to do that again, I said as soon as I saw her.
She paused a few feet away from me, and a frustrated expression that I knew well crossed her face. I laughed.
What do you want to know? I'll tell you what I'm thinking.
She frowned.
I don't understand. You're in a very good mood.
Oh, is that wrong?
Aren't you incredibly thirsty?
I swallowed against the burn. It was bad, but not as bad as the rest of the fire I'd just left behind. The thirst burn was always there, and it got worse when I focused on it. But there were so many other things to focus on.
Yes, when I think about it.
Edith squared her shoulders.
If you want to do this first, that's fine too.
I looked at her. I was obviously missing something.
Do this? Do what?
She stared at me for a second, her eyes doubtful. Suddenly, she threw her hands up.
You know, I really thought that when your mind was more similar to mine, I'd be able to hear it. I guess that's never going to happen.
Sorry. She laughed,
but there was an unhappy note in the sound. Honestly, Beau, can you please give me a clue as to what we're talking about? You wanted us to be alone, she said, like this was an explanation. Yeah. Because you had some things you wanted to say to me? She braced her shoulders again, tensing like she was expecting something bad. Oh, well, I guess there are things to say. I mean, there's one important thing, but I wasn't thinking about that. Seeing how frustrated she was by whatever misunderstanding was happening, I was totally honest. I wanted to be alone with you because, well, I didn't want to be rude, but I also didn't want to do this hunting thing in front of Eleanor, I confessed. I figured there was a good chance I would screw something up, and I don't know Eleanor all that well yet, but I have a feeling she would find that pretty funny. Her eyes got wide. You were afraid Eleanor would laugh at you? Really, that's all? Really. Your turn, Edith. What did you think was happening? She hesitated. I thought you were being a gentleman. I thought you preferred to yell at me alone rather than in front of my family. I froze up again. I wondered if that was going to happen every time I was surprised. It took me a second to thaw out. Yell at you? I repeated. Edith. Oh, you're talking about all that stuff you were saying in the car, right? Sorry about that, I... Sorry? What on earth are you apologizing for now, Beau Swan? She looked angry. Angry and so beautiful. I couldn't guess why she was worked up. I shrugged. I wanted to tell you then, but I couldn't. I mean, I couldn't even really concentrate. Of course you couldn't concentrate. Edith! I crossed the space between us in one invisibly fast stride and put my hands on her shoulders. You'll never know what I'm thinking if you keep interrupting me. The anger on her face faded as she deliberately calmed herself. Then she nodded. Okay, I said. In the car, I wanted to tell you then that you didn't need to apologize. I felt horrible that you were so sad. This isn't your fault. She started to say something, so I put my finger over her lips. And it isn't all bad, I continued. Well, my head is still spinning, and I know there are a million things to think about, and I'm sad, of course, but I'm also good, Edith. I'm always good when I'm with you. She stared at me for a long minute. Slowly, she raised her hand to pull my finger away from her mouth. I didn't stop her. You aren't angry at me for what I've done to you? She asked quietly. Edith, you saved my life. Again. Why would I be angry? Because of the way you saved it? What else could you have done? She exhaled, almost like she was mad again. How can you... Bo, you have to see that this is all my fault. I haven't saved your life. I've taken it from you. Charlie, Renee... I put my finger over her mouth again, and then took a deep breath. Yes, it's hard, and it's going to be hard for a long time. Maybe forever, right? But why would I put that on you? Joss is the one who, well, who killed me. You brought me back to life. She pushed my hand down. If I hadn't involved you in my world, I laughed. And she looked up at me like I'd lost my mind. Edith, if you hadn't involved me in your world, Charlie and Renee would have lost me 3 months earlier. She stared, frowning. It was obvious she wasn't accepting any of this. Do you remember what I said when you saved my life in Port Angeles? The second time, or third? I barely did. The words were easier to bring back than the images. I knew it went something like this. That you were messing with fate because my number was up? Well, if I had to die, Edith, isn't this the most amazing way to do it? A long minute passed while she stared at me, and then she shook her head. Bo, you are amazing.
I guess I am now.
You always have been.
I didn't say anything, and my face gave me away. Or she was just that good. She knew my face so well. She spent so much time trying so hard to understand me that she knew immediately when there was something I wasn't saying.
What is it, Bo?
Just something Joss said. I winced. Though it was hard to see things in my old memory, the dance studio was the most recent, the most vivid. Edith's jaw got hard.
She said a lot of things, she hissed.
Oh. Suddenly I wanted to punch something. But I also didn't want to let go of Edith to do that.
You saw the tape.
Her face was totally white, furious and agonized at the same time.
Yes, I saw the tape.
When? I didn't hear.
Headphones.
I wish you hadn't. She shook her head.
I had to. But forget that now.
Which lie were you thinking of?
She spit the words through her teeth.
It took me a minute.
You didn't want me to be a vampire.
No, I absolutely did not. So that part wasn't a lie, and you've been so upset. I know you feel bad about Charlie and my mom, but I guess I'm worried that part of it is because, well, you didn't expect to have me around very long. You weren't planning for that.
Her mouth flew open so fast that I put my whole hand over it.
Because if that's what it is, don't worry. If you want me to go away after a while, I can. You can show me what to do so I won't get either of us in trouble. I don't expect you to put up with me forever. You didn't choose this any more than I did. I want you to know that I'm aware of that.
She waited for me to move my hand. I did it slowly. I wasn't sure I wanted to hear what was next.
She growled softly and flashed her teeth at me. Not in a smile.
You're lucky I didn't bite you, she said.
The next time you put your hand on my mouth to say something so completely idiotic and insulting, I will.
Sorry.
She closed her eyes. Her arms wrapped around my waist and she leaned her head against my chest. My arms wound around her automatically. She tilted her face up so that she could look at me.
I want you to listen to me very carefully, Bo. This having you with me, getting to keep you here, it's like I've been granted every selfish wish I've ever had. But the price for everything I want was to take the exact same thing away from you. All of your life. I'm angry with myself. I'm disappointed in myself. And I wish so much that I could bring that tracker back to life so that I could kill her myself over and over and over again. The reason I didn't want you to be a vampire wasn't because you weren't special enough. It was because you are too special and you deserve more. I wanted you to have what we all miss, a human life. But you have to know, if it were only about me, if there were no price for you to pay, then tonight would be the best night of my life. I've been staring forever in the face for a century, and tonight is the very first time it's looked beautiful to me. Because of you. Don't you ever think again that I don't want you. I will always want you. I don't deserve you, but I will always love you. Are we clear?
It was obvious that she was being totally sincere. Truth echoed in every word. A huge grin spread across my new face.
So, that's okay then.
She smiled back.
I'd say so.
That was the one important thing I wanted to say. Just, I love you. I always will. I knew that from pretty early in. So with that being how things are, I think we can work the rest out. I held her face in my hands and bent down to kiss her. Like everything else, this was so easy now. Nothing to worry about. No hesitation.
It felt strange, though, that my heart wasn't beating out a crazy drum solo, that the blood wasn't stampeding through my veins. But something was zinging through me like electricity, every nerve in my body alive. More than alive. Like all of my cells were rejoicing. I only wanted to hold her like this, and I would need nothing else for the next 100 years. But she broke away, and she was laughing. This time her laugh was full of joy. It sounded like singing. "How are you doing this?" she laughed. "You're supposed to be a newborn vampire, and here you are, discussing the future calmly with me, smiling at me, kissing me. You're supposed to be thirsty and nothing else."
"I'm a lot of else," I said. "But I am pretty thirsty, now that you mention it."
She leaned up on her toes and kissed me once, hard.
"I love you. Let's go hunt."
We ran together into the darkness that wasn't dark, and I was unafraid. This would be easy, I knew. Just like everything else. Epilogue. An occasion.
"Are you sure this was a good idea?" she asked.
"I should be here.
Tell me if it gets to be too much."
I nodded. We were 100 feet up in the branches of a tall hemlock, sitting side by side on a thick bough. I had my arm around her, and she held my other hand in both of hers. I could feel her eyes on my face, worried. The branch swayed under us in the wind. About 2 miles away, a caravan of cars was driving up Kalawa Way with all their headlights on, though it was daytime. We were southeast and upwind, carefully situated so that we wouldn't be close to any people. It was too far for Edith to be able to hear much of what anyone was thinking, but that was okay. I was sure I'd be able to guess most of it. The first car was the hearse. Right behind it was the familiar cruiser. My mom was in the passenger seat, and Phil was in the back. I recognized almost everyone in the cars that followed. I couldn't watch the actual funeral. It had been held inside a church building. The graveside service would have to be enough. The hearse was overkill. There hadn't been enough of the body that they'd found inside the burned-out shell of my truck to need a casket. If I'd been able to consult with my parents, I would have told them not to waste the money and just get an urn. But I guess if it made them feel better, maybe they really wanted a grave to visit. I'd seen where they were putting me, or what they thought was me. The hole was dug yesterday, right beside Grandma and Grandpa Swan. They'd both died when I was little, so I hadn't known them well. I hope they didn't mind having a stranger next to them. I didn't know the stranger's name. I hadn't wanted to know every detail about how Archie and Eleanor had faked my death. I just knew that someone roughly my size, who had been recently interred, had taken one last trip. I assumed that all the identifiers had been destroyed, teeth, prints, etc. I felt pretty bad for the guy, but I suppose he didn't mind. He hadn't felt anything when the truck veered into a ravine somewhere in Nevada and burst into flames. His family had already mourned. They had a tombstone with his name on it, like my parents had now. Charlie and my mom were both pallbearers. Even from this distance, I could see that Charlie looked 20 years older, and my mom moved like she was sleepwalking. If she hadn't had the casket to hold on to, I'm not sure she would have been able to walk in a straight line across the cemetery lawn. I recognized the black dress she was wearing. She'd bought it for a formal party and then decided it aged her. She'd ended up going to the party in red. Charlie wore a suit I'd never seen before. I would guess it was old rather than new. It didn't look like it would button, and his tie was a little too wide. Phil helped too, and Alan and his dad, Reverend Weber. Jeremy walked behind Alan. Even Bonnie Black held on to one of the brass handles while Jules pushed her chair. In the crowd, I saw almost every person I knew from school. Most were in black, and lots of them were holding each other and crying.
It kind of surprised me. I didn't know many of them very well. I guess they were just crying because it was sad in general. Someone dying when they were only 17. It probably made them think about their own mortality and all of that. One group of people stood out. Corrine, Ernest, Archie, Jessamine, Royal, and Eleanor, all in light gray. They held themselves straighter than anyone else, and even from a distance, their skin was obviously different, at least to a vampire's eyes. It all seemed to take a really long time, lowering the casket, the reverend giving some kind of speech, a sermon, my mom and dad each throwing a flower into the hole after the casket, everyone awkwardly forming the obligatory line to speak to my parents. I wish they would let my mom leave. She was sagging into Phil, and I knew she needed to lie down. Charlie was holding up better, but he looked brittle. Jules wheeled Bonnie over so that she was behind him, a little to the side. Bonnie reached forward and took Charlie's hand. It looked like that helped some. This put Jules in a position where I could see her face really well, and I kind of wished I couldn't. Corrine and the rest of the Cullens were near the end of the line. We watched as they made their way slowly to the front. They were quick with my mom. They'd never met her before. Archie brought a chair up for my mom to sit in, and Phil thanked him. I wondered if Archie had seen that she was going to fall. Corrine spent more time with Charlie. I knew she was apologizing for Edith's absence, explaining that she'd been too distraught to come. This was more than just an excuse for Edith to be with me today. It was laying groundwork for the next school year, when Edith would continue to be so distraught that Ernest would decide to homeschool her. I watched as Bonnie and Jules left while Charlie was still talking to Corrine. Bonnie threw a dark glance back at the Cullens, then suddenly stared in my direction. Of course she couldn't see us. I glanced around, trying to figure out what she was looking at. I realized that Eleanor was looking at us too. She had no trouble spotting us, and she was trying very hard not to smile. Eleanor never took anything seriously. Bonnie must have wondered what Eleanor was staring at. Bonnie looked away after a few seconds. She said something to Jules. They continued out to their car. The Cullens left after the Blacks. The line dwindled, and finally my parents were free. Phil took my mom away quickly. The Reverend gave them a ride. Charlie stayed alone while the funeral home employees filled the hole in. He didn't watch. He sat in the chair that my mom had used and stared away to the north. I felt my face working, trying to find the expression that went with my grief. My eyes were too dry. I blinked against the uncomfortable feeling. When I took my next breath, the air hitched out of my throat, like I was choking on it. Edith's arms wrapped tight around my waist. I buried my face in her hair. "I'm so sorry, Beau. I never wanted this for you." I just nodded. We sat like that for a long time. She nudged me when Charlie left, so I could watch him drive away. "Do you want to go home?" she asked. "Maybe in a little while." "All right." We stared at the mostly empty cemetery. It was starting to get darker. A few employees were cleaning up chairs and trash. One of them took away the big picture of me, my school picture from the beginning of junior year back in Phoenix. I'd never liked that one much. I hardly recognized the boy with the uncertain blue eyes and the half-hearted smile. It was difficult to remember being him. Hard to imagine how he must have looked to Edith back in the beginning. "You never wanted this for me," I said slowly. "What did you want? How did you see things happening? Going with the fact that I was always going to be in love with you." She sighed. "Best case scenario? I hoped that I would get strong enough that we could be together while you were human. That we could be something more than just boyfriend and girlfriend. Someday, if you didn't outgrow me, more than just husband and wife. We wouldn't be able to grow old together,
but I would have stayed with you while you grew old. I would have been with you through all the years of your life. She paused for a second. And then, when your life was over, I wouldn't have wanted to stay without you. I would have found a way to follow. She looked startled when I laughed. It wasn't a very robust laugh, but I was surprised that it felt good. That was a really, really horrible idea, I told her. Can you imagine when people thought I was your dad? Your granddad? I'd probably get locked up. She smiled hesitantly. That wouldn't have bothered me. And if anyone had you locked up, I would have busted you out. But you would have married me? I asked. Really? Now she smiled wider. I still will. Archie's seen it. I blinked a few times. Wow. I'm super flattered. You would really marry me, Edith? Is that a proposal? I thought for half a second. Sure. Sure it is. Will you? She threw her arms around me. Of course I will. Whenever you want. Wow, I said again. I hugged her back and kissed the top of her head. I think I could have done better with the other version, though. She leaned back to look at me, and her face was sad again. Any other way ended here, too. But there could have been a better goodbye. I didn't want to think about what my last words to Charlie were, but they were constantly on my mind. It was the biggest regret I had. I was glad the memory wasn't sharp, and I only hoped it would fade more with time. What if we had gotten married? You know, graduated together, put in a few years at college, then had a great big wedding where we invited everyone we knew, let them all see us happy together, give really sappy speeches, have a reason to tell everyone how much we love them, then go away again, back to school, somewhere far away. She sighed. That sounds nice, but you end up with a double funeral in the end. Maybe. Maybe we'd be really busy for a year, and when I'm a mature vampire and all under control, I could see them again. Right, she said, rolling her eyes. And then all we have to worry about is never aging, and getting on the bad side of the Volturi. I'm sure that would end well. Okay, you're right. There's no other version. I'm sorry, she said quietly again. Either way, though, Edith, if I hadn't been dumb enough to run off and meet that tracker... She hissed, but I kept talking. It would only have delayed things. We still end up here. You're the life I choose. She smiled, slowly at first, but then suddenly her smile was huge and dimpled. It feels like my life never had a point until I found you. You're the life I was waiting for. I took her face in my hands and kissed her while the branch swayed back and forth under us. I never could have imagined a life like this. There was a heavy price to pay, but one I would have chosen to pay even if I'd had all the time in the world to consider. We both felt it when her phone vibrated in her pocket. I figured it would be Eleanor, sarcastically wondering if we'd gotten lost on our way back. But then Edith answered the phone. Corrine? She listened for just 1 second, her eyes flying open. I could hear Corrine's voice trilling at top speed on the other end. Edith shoved off the branch, phone still in hand. I'm coming, she promised as she fell toward the ground, breaking her fall with a branch here and there. I swung down quickly after her. She was already running when I hit the ground, and she didn't slow for me to catch up. It must be really serious. I ran flat out, using all the extra strength that I had because I was new. It was enough to keep her in sight as she sprinted across the most direct route back to the house. My strides were almost 3 times as long as hers, but still, Chasing her was like chasing a bolt of lightning. It was only when we were close to the house that she let me catch up. "Be careful," she warned me. "We have visitors." And then she was off again. I pushed myself even harder to try to match her. I didn't have a positive perception of visitors. I didn't want her to meet them without me next to her. I could hear snarling before we were at the river. Edith kept her leap low and straight, hurtling up the lawn. The metal shutters were down across the glass wall. She ran around the south end of the house. I was on her heels the whole way. She darted over the railing onto the porch. All the Cullens were there, huddled into a tight, defensive cluster. Corrine was a few steps in front of them, though I could tell no one was happy to have her there. She was leaning toward the steps, staring forward, a pleading look on her face. Edith lunged to her side, and something snarled in the darkness in front of the house. I launched myself onto the porch, and Eleanor yanked my arm back when I tried to go to Edith. "Let her translate," Eleanor murmured. Ready to rip out of her hands, not even Eleanor was strong enough to stop me while I was so young. I looked out past Corrine to see the vampires we were facing. I'm not sure what I was expecting. A large group, maybe, since the Cullens seemed so defensive. I wasn't prepared to see three horse-sized wolves. They weren't growling now. All of their massive heads were up, their noses pointing at me. The one in the lead, pitch black and larger than either of the others, though they were both three times bigger than I'd ever dreamed a wolf could get, took a step forward, his teeth bared. "Sam," Edith said sharply. The wolf's head swung around to face her. "You have no right to be here. We haven't broken the treaty." The black monster wolf snarled at her. "They didn't attack," Corrine said to Edith. "I don't know what they want. They want us to leave. They were trying to drive you out." "But why?" Corrine asked. The wolves seemed to be listening intently to every word. Could they understand? "They thought we broke the treaty. That we killed Bo." The big wolf growled long and low. It sounded like a saw being dragged over chain link. "But," Corrine began. "Obviously," Edith answered before she could finish, "they still think we broke the treaty, that we chose to change him ourselves." Corrine looked at the wolves. "I can promise you, that's not how this happened." The one Edith called Sam kept up the long growl. Flecks of saliva dripped from his exposed fangs. "Bo," Edith murmured. "Can you tell them? They aren't going to believe us." I'd been frozen solid this whole time. I tried to shake off the surprise as I moved to stand by Edith. "I don't understand. What are they? What treaty are you talking about?" I whispered the words fast, but it was obvious from the wolves' alert ears and watchful eyes that they were listening. Wolves that understood English? Eleanor had said Edith was translating. Did she speak wolf? "Bo," Edith said in a louder voice. "These are the Quileute wolves. You remember the story?" I stared at the massive animals. "They're werewolves?" The black wolf growled louder, but the dark one in the back blew out a funny huff that sounded almost like a laugh. "Not exactly," Edith said. "A long time ago, we made a treaty with another pack leader. They think we violated it. Can you tell them how you were transformed?" Okay. I looked at the black wolf, who seemed to be in charge. I'm Bo Swan. She knows who you are. You met Sam once, at the beach in La Push." She. The cloudy human memories distracted me for a short second. I remembered the tall woman at La Push, and Jules saying that the wolves were her sisters. that her great-great-grandmother had made a treaty with the Cold Ones.
Oh, I said.
Just explain to her what happened.
Right. I looked at the wolf again, trying to picture the tall woman somehow inside it.
A few weeks ago, there was a tracker, or a vampire tracker, who came through here. She liked the way I smelled. The Cullens told her to back off. She left, but Edith knew she was planning to try to kill me. I went back to Phoenix to hide out till the Cullens could, well, take care of her, you know. But the tracker figured out where I was and caught up to me. It was a game to her, a game with the Cullens. I was just a pawn. But she didn't want to just kill me. I guess you could say she was playing with her food. The Cullens found me before she could kill me, but she'd already bitten me. Hey, do we still have the video? I glanced over at Edith, who was staring at the wolves. She shook her head. I turned back to Sam. That's too bad. The tracker was filming the whole thing. I could have shown you exactly what happened. The wolves looked at each other. Edith's eyes were narrowed as she concentrated on what they were thinking. Suddenly the black wolf was staring at her again. That's acceptable, Edith said.
Where?
The black wolf huffed, and then all three were backing away from the house. When they got to the edge of the trees, they turned and ran into the forest.
The Cullens all converged on Edith.
What happened? Corrine asked.
They aren't sure what to do, Edith said. They were asked to clear us out. Sam is the actual chief of the tribe, but only in secret. She's not a direct descendant of the chief we made a treaty with. They want us to talk to the acting chief, the true great-granddaughter of the last wolf chief.
But wouldn't that be Bonnie?
I gasped.
Edith looked at me.
Yes. They want to meet at a neutral location so that Bonnie can see you and make the call.
See me? But I can't get that close.
You can do it, Beau, Edith said. You're the most rational newborn I've ever seen.
It's true, Corrine agreed. I've never seen anyone adapt so easily. If I didn't know better, I'd say you were a decade old.
It wasn't that I thought they were lying, just that maybe they didn't get the magnitude of what they were proposing.
But it's Bonnie. She's my dad's best friend. What if I hurt her?
We'll be there, Eleanor said. We won't let you do anything stupid.
Actually, Edith said.
Eleanor looked at her, shocked.
They asked that we bring no more than their pack, only three.
I already agreed. Beau has to be one, I have to be one, and the other needs to be Corrine.
It was clear Eleanor was hurt.
Is that safe? Ernest asked.
Edith shrugged.
It's not an ambush. Or they hadn't decided to make it one.
Not yet, Jessamine said. She was standing protectively by Archie, and there was something wrong with him. He looked a little dazed.
Archie? I asked. I'd never seen him look like he was behind things instead of ahead of them.
I didn't see them, he whispered. I didn't know they were coming.
I can't see now. I can't see this meeting. It's like it didn't exist. I could see that this was news only to me. The others had heard it before we'd arrived, and Edith had already picked it out of his head.
What does that mean? I asked.
We don't know, Edith answered sharply. And we don't have time to figure it out now. We want to be there when they arrive. We don't want them to have a chance to change their minds.
It will be fine, Corrine said to the others, her eyes on Ernest. The wolves are just trying to protect the people here. They're heroes, not villains.
They think we're villains, Royal pointed out. Heroes or not, Corrine, we still have to accept that there are enemies.
It doesn't have to be that way, Corrine whispered. And it doesn't matter either way tonight, Edith said. Tonight, Bo needs to explain to Bonnie so that we don't have to make the choice between leaving Forks and raising suspicions, or getting into a fight with three barely legal wolves who are just trying to protect their tribe. Archie can't see if you'll be in danger, Jessamine reminded her. We'll be fine. Bonnie won't want to hurt Bo. I'm not sure that's true now, and I know she won't have any problem watching you get hurt. I can hear the wolves just fine. They won't take us by surprise.
Tell us where to go, Eleanor said. We'll keep our distance and only come in if you call.
I promised. There's no reason to go back on my word. We need them to see that they can trust us, now more than ever.
No, Edith said, as Jessamine apparently thought of another argument.
We don't have time. We'll be back soon.
Eleanor grumbled, but Edith ignored her.
Bo, Corrine, let's go.
I took off after her, and I could hear Corrine do the same. Edith didn't run as fast this time, and we both easily kept up.
You seem very confident, Corrine said to Edith. I got a good look at their minds. They don't want this fight either. There are eight of us. They know they won't win if it comes to actual bloodshed.
It can't. I won't hurt them.
I'm not in disagreement with that, but it would cause problems if we left now.
I know. I listened, but my thoughts were far away, thinking about Bonnie and Charlie and the fact that I should be nowhere near human beings right now. I'd heard plenty from the others about the newborn years, especially Jessamine, and I wasn't ready to try to be the first exception to the rule. Sure, I hadn't had a hard time picking up most things, and everyone was surprised by how calm I was, but this was different. Edith had been very careful to make sure I was never tested when it came to the most important thing, not killing anyone. And if I screwed up tonight, not only would I destroy my father's world, he needed a friend now like he'd never had before, but I'd also ignite some kind of war between the Cullens and the giant werewolves. I'd never felt clumsy in this new body, but suddenly that same sense of impending doom was hanging over me. Here was my chance to mess things up in a really spectacular way. Edith led us northeast. We crossed the freeway where it turned east toward Port Angeles and continued due north for a short time, following a smaller road. Edith stopped in a wasteland on the side of the dark road, a large clearing recently made by loggers.
Edith, I don't think I can do this.
She took my hand.
We're upwind. Corrine and I will try to stop you if something happens. Just remember not to fight us.
What if I can't control it? What if I hurt you?
Don't panic, Bo. I know you can do this. Hold your breath. Run away if it gets bad.
But Edith, she put her finger to her lips and stared southward. It wasn't long before a set of headlights turned into view. I was expecting the car to pass. After all, the wolves wouldn't even fit inside the little sedan. But it slowly came to a stop not far from where we waited, and I realized it was Bonnie inside, and someone else in the driver's seat. Then two of the wolves were there, coming from the forest on the other side of the road. They split to move around the car on either side. It looked protective. The woman in the driver's seat got out and came around to get Bonnie. I was sure it wasn't Sam, though her hair was just as short. I stared at her, wondering if I'd met her on the beach too, but she didn't look familiar. Like Sam, she was tall and looked strong. Clearly she didn't just look strong. She picked Bonnie up in her arms and carried her like the older woman weighed nothing. Kind of like the way the Cullens had thrown me around as if I were a feather pillow. Maybe the wolves, because obviously this was the gray wolf who was missing from the original trio, were stronger than normal humans too. Sam and the dark brown wolf led the way as the tall woman carried Bonnie behind them.
Sam stopped a good 30 yards away from where we stood.
I can't see as well as you, I heard Bonnie say tartly.
Sam prowled another 10 yards forward.
Hello, Bonnie, Corrine said.
I can't see, Paula, Bonnie complained again.
Her voice sounded rough and weak to me. I'd been listening to no one but vampires for a month. The half-wolf, half-human pack moved slowly forward until they were only 10 yards away. I held my breath, even though the light wind still blew from behind me.
Corrine Cullen, Bonnie said coldly. I should have put it together sooner. It wasn't till I saw you at the funeral that I realized what had happened.
But you were wrong, Edith said.
That's what Sam says, Bonnie answered. I'm not sure she's right.
Bonnie's eyes flickered to me, and she shuddered.
All we have is Beau's word and our own. Will you believe either? Edith asked.
Bonnie harrumphed, but didn't answer.
Please, Corrine said, and her voice was much kinder than either of the others. We've never hurt anyone here. We won't start now. It would be better for us not to leave immediately. Otherwise, we would go without an argument.
You don't want to look guilty, Bonnie agreed sarcastically.
No, we would rather not, Corrine said. And in truth, we are not in breach.
Bonnie looked at me.
Then where is Beau?
Do you expect me to believe he's inside that thing that bears some slight resemblance to him?
Hurt was strong in her voice, but so was hate.
I was surprised by her reaction. Did I really seem so different? Like I wasn't even here?
Bonnie, it's me, I said.
She winced at my voice. I was out of air. I gripped Edith's hand and took a shallow breath. Still upwind, it was okay.
I know I look and sound a little different, but I'm still me, Bonnie.
So you say.
I raised my free hand helplessly. I don't know how to convince you. What I told Sam was true. Another vampire bit me. She would have killed me, too, except that the Cullens got there in time. They didn't do anything wrong. They were always trying to protect me.
If they hadn't gotten involved with you, this would never have happened. Charlie's life wouldn't be broken in pieces. You'd still be the boy I knew.
I'd had this argument before, and I was prepared.
Bonnie, there's something you didn't know about me. I used to smell really good to vampires.
She flinched. If the Cullens hadn't been here, those other vampires would still have come to Forks. They might have killed more than me while they were here, but I can promise you, if Charlie had survived, he would be missing me just the same. And there would be nothing left of the boy you used to know. You might not be able to see it, but I'm still here, Bonnie.
Bonnie shook her head. Less angry, though, I thought. More sad.
She looked at Corrine.
I'll concede that the treaty is intact. Will you tell me your plans?
We'll stay here another year. We'll leave after Edith and Archie graduate. It will look natural that way.
Bonnie nodded.
All right. We'll wait. I apologize for our infraction tonight.
She sighed.
It was a mistake. I was overwrought.
We understand, Corrine said softly. There was no harm done. Maybe even some good. It's better to understand each other as much as possible. Perhaps we could even talk again some.
The treaty is unbroken, Bonnie said in a hard voice. Don't ask any more from us.
Corrine nodded once. Bonnie looked at me again and her face fell. The breeze shifted. Edith and Corrine both grabbed my arms at the same time. Bonnie's eyes went wide and then narrowed angrily. Sam snarled once. What are you doing to him? Bonnie demanded.
Protecting you, Edith snapped.
The dark brown wolf took a half step forward. I took a quick breath, preparing myself to run if it was bad. It was bad. Bonnie's scent was like fire as it rushed down my throat, but it was more than just pain. It was 1,000 times more appealing than any of the animals I'd hunted, not even in the same class. It was like someone waving a perfectly cooked filet mignon in front of me after I'd been living on stale crackers for a year. But more than that. I'd never used drugs, but I thought Edith's heroin comparison might be the closer version. And yet, while I wanted to quench my thirst, badly, I knew instantly that I didn't have to. I wouldn't want to be any closer to her, no, but I was pretty sure I could handle it even then. I'd expected that when the newborn thing reared its ugly head, I wouldn't be able to think or decide, that I wouldn't be a person anymore. I'd be an animal. I was still me. A very thirsty me, but me. It took only half a second for me to figure all this out.
No, don't worry, Bonnie, I said quickly. I'm new to this, and they don't want me to lose it, you know? But I'm okay.
Edith slowly took her hand off my arm. Corrine looked at me, her face kind of odd. Bonnie's eyes were still narrowed, but I could see she was confused, too. She hadn't expected me to act so much like myself, maybe. I decided to take advantage of the unexpected opportunity. I took another breath, and though it hurt just as badly, I knew I was fine.
So it sounds like I won't have a chance to talk to you again, I said. And I'm sorry it's that way. I guess I don't understand all the rules yet. But since you're here, if I could just ask one favor.
Her face got hard again.
What?
My dad. My breath did that weird hitching thing again, and I had to take a second before I could go on. Edith put her hand on my back, but it was for comfort this time. Please just take care of him. Don't let him be alone too much. I never wanted to do this to him, or my mom. That's the hardest part of all this. For me, it's fine. I'm good. If only there was anything I could do to make it better for them, I would. But I can't. Could you please watch out for him?
Bonnie's face went blank for a minute. I couldn't read it.
I wished I could hear like Edith did.
I would have done that regardless, Bonnie finally said.
I know. I couldn't help asking, though. Do you think you could let me know if ever there is something I can do? You know, from behind the scenes?
She nodded slowly.
I suppose there may be some of Beau left after all. I sighed. She was not going to believe it if I told her that all of me was left, that there was just more added on top.
Is there anything else I can do for you?
I froze for 1/10 of a second, surprised by the offer. I could tell Edith and Corrine were surprised too. But there was something more I wanted.
If, I began, will you ever tell Jules about any of this?
I looked at the enormous wolves flanking Bonnie.
Or will it always be a secret?
I didn't understand the look that crossed her face now.
Jules will know soon enough.
Oh, okay. Well, if she can know about me, can you tell her that I'm happy? It's not so bad, this whole vampire thing.
Bonnie shuddered.
I'll tell her what you said.
Thanks, Bonnie.
She nodded. Then she looked at the tall girl carrying her and jerked her chin back the way they'd come. As they turned, I saw a tear escape the corner of her eye. The wolves backed away from us, too. I hoped it wasn't the last time I would see Bonnie. I hoped that when Jules was in on the secret, I would be allowed to see her, too. or at least talk to her again. I hoped that maybe someday the wolves would see that the Cullens were heroes too. Bonnie's car drove away. The wolves melted into the trees. I waited until Edith was done listening to their departure. "Tell me everything," I said. She smiled. "I will when we get home, so I don't have to repeat all of it. There was a lot." She shook her head, like she was amazed. We started running, not so fast as before. Huh, actual werewolves. This world is even weirder than I thought, I said.
Agreed, Edith said.
That's right. You thought there weren't werewolves here anymore. That must have been kind of a shock. They weren't the most shocking thing I saw tonight. I looked at her, then at Corrine. Corrine smiled like she was in on some joke. I mean, I knew you were special, Beau, but that was something else back there. Jessamine's not going to believe it.
Oh, but... I stared at her.
You said you knew I could do this. She dimpled. Well, I was pretty sure the wind would hold steady. Corrine laughed, then she exchanged a glance with Edith. She sped up as Edith slowed. In a second, we were alone. I kept pace with Edith, and stopped when she stopped. She put her hands on either side of my face.
It's been a long day, a hard one. But I want you to know that you're extraordinary, and I love you.
I pulled her tight against me. I can handle anything as long as you're with me. She wrapped her arms around my neck.
Then here I will stay.
Forever, I said.
Forever,
she agreed. I leaned down until my lips found hers. Forever was going to be amazing. This is Michael Crouch. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Life and Death, Twilight Reimagined, by Stephanie Meyer. Executive producer, Karen Jakonski. Directed by Karen Jakonski and Sarah Jaffe. Text copyright 2015 by Stephanie Meyer. Production copyright 2015, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Listening Library presents Twilight by Stephanie Meyer. Read for you by Ileana Kadushin. But of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, thou shalt not eat of it. For in the day that thou eatest thereof, thou shalt surely die. Genesis 2:17. I'd never given much thought to how I would die, though I'd had reason enough in the last few months. But even if I had, I would not have imagined it like this. I stared without breathing across the long room, into the dark eyes of the hunter, and he looked pleasantly back at me. Surely it was a good way to die, in the place of someone else, someone I loved, noble even. That ought to count for something. I knew that if I'd never gone to Forks, I wouldn't be facing death now. But terrified as I was, I couldn't bring myself to regret the decision. When life offers you a dream so far beyond any of your expectations, it's not reasonable to grieve when it comes to end. The hunter smiled in a friendly way as he sauntered forward to kill me. Chapter 1. First Sight. My mother drove me to the airport with the windows rolled down. It was 75 degrees in Phoenix, the sky a perfect cloudless blue. I was wearing my favorite shirt, sleeveless white eyelet lace. I was wearing it as a farewell gesture. My carry-on item was a parka. In the Olympic Peninsula of Northwest Washington State, a small town named Forks exists under a near constant cover of clouds. It rains on this inconsequential town more than any other place in the United States of America. It was from this town and its gloomy, omnipresent shade that my mother escaped with me when I was only a few months old. It was in this town that I'd been compelled to spend a month every summer until I was 14. That was the year I finally put my foot down. These past three summers, my dad, Charlie, vacationed with me in California for 2 weeks instead. It was to Forks that I now exiled myself, an action that I took with great horror. I detested Forks. I loved Phoenix. I loved the sun and the blistering heat. I loved the vigorous, sprawling city. Bella, my mom said to me, the last of 1,000 times before I got on the plane, you don't have to do this. My mom looks like me, except with short hair and laugh lines. I felt a spasm of panic as I stared at her wide, childlike eyes. How could I leave my loving, erratic, harebrained mother to fend for herself? Of course, she had Phil now, so the bills would probably get paid. There would be food in the refrigerator, gas in her car, and someone to call when she got lost. But still, I want to go, I lied. I'd always been a bad liar. But I've been saying this lie so frequently lately that it sounded almost convincing now. Tell Charlie I said hi. I will. I'll see you soon, she insisted. You can come home whenever you want. I'll come right back as soon as you need me. But I could see the sacrifice in her eyes behind the promise. Don't worry about me, I urged. It'll be great. I love you, Mom. She hugged me tightly for a minute, and then I got on the plane, and she was gone. It's a 4-hour flight from Phoenix to Seattle, another hour in a small plane up to Port Angeles, and then an hour drive back down to Forks. Flying doesn't bother me. The hour in the car with Charlie, though, I was a little worried about. Charlie had really been fairly nice about the whole thing. He seemed genuinely pleased that I was coming to live with him for the first time with any degree of permanence. He'd already gotten me registered for high school and was going to help me get a car. But it was sure to be awkward with Charlie. Neither of us was what anyone would call verbose, and I didn't know what there was to say regardless. I knew he was more than a little confused by my decision. Like my mother before me, I hadn't made a secret of my distaste for Forks. When I landed in Port Angeles, it was raining. I didn't see it as an omen, just unavoidable. I'd already said my goodbyes to the sun. Charlie was waiting for me with the cruiser. This I was expecting too. Charlie is Police Chief Swan to the good people of Forks. My primary motivation behind buying a car, despite the scarcity of my funds, was that I refused to be driven around town in a car with red and blue lights on top. Nothing slows down traffic like a cop. Charlie gave me an awkward one-armed hug when I stumbled my way off the plane. It's good to see you, Bells, he said, smiling as he automatically caught and steadied me. You haven't changed much. How's Renee? Mom's fine. It's good to see you too, Dad. I wasn't allowed to call him Charlie to his face. I had only a few bags. Most of my Arizona clothes were too permeable for Washington. My mom and I had pooled our resources to supplement my winter wardrobe, but it was still scanty. It all fit easily into the trunk of the cruiser. I found a good car for you, really cheap, he announced when we were strapped in. What kind of car? I was suspicious of the way he said, good car for you, as opposed to just good car. Well, it's a truck, actually, a Chevy. Where did you find it? Do you remember Billy Black down at La Push? La Push is the tiny Indian reservation on the coast. No. He used to go fishing with us during the summer, Charlie prompted. That would explain why I didn't remember him. I do a good job of blocking painful, unnecessary things from my memory. He's in a wheelchair now, Charlie continued when I didn't respond. So he can't drive anymore, and he offered to sell me his truck cheap. What year is it? I could see from his change of expression that this was the question he was hoping I wouldn't ask. Well, Billy's done a lot of work on the engine. It's only a few years old, really. I hoped he didn't think so little of me as to believe I would give up that easily. When did he buy it?
He bought it in 1984, I think.
Did he buy it new?
Well, no. I think it was new in the early 60s or late 50s at the earliest, he admitted sheepishly. Dad, I don't really know anything about cars. I wouldn't be able to fix it if anything went wrong, and I couldn't afford a mechanic.
Really, Bella, the thing runs great. They don't build them like that anymore.
The thing, I thought to myself. It had possibilities, as a nickname, at the very least. How cheap is cheap? After all, that was the part I couldn't compromise on. Well, honey, I kind of already bought it for you, as a homecoming gift. Charlie peeked sideways at me with a hopeful expression.
Wow, free.
You didn't need to do that, Dad. I was going to buy myself a car.
I don't mind. I want you to be happy here.
He was looking ahead at the road when he said this. Charlie wasn't comfortable with expressing his emotions out loud. I inherited that from him. So I was looking straight ahead as I responded.
It's really nice, Dad. Thanks. I really appreciate it.
No need to add that my being happy in Forks is an impossibility. He didn't need to suffer along with me. And I never looked a free truck in the mouth, or engine.
Well now, you're welcome, he mumbled, embarrassed by my thanks.
We exchanged a few more comments on the weather, which was wet, and that was pretty much it for conversation. We stared out the windows in silence. It was beautiful, of course, I couldn't deny that. Everything was green, the trees, their trunks covered with moss, their branches hanging with a canopy of it, the ground covered with ferns. Even the air filtered down greenly through the leaves. It was too green, an alien planet. Eventually, we made it to Charlie's. He still lived in the small, two-bedroom house that he bought with my mother in the early days of their marriage. Those were the only kind of days their marriage had, the early ones. There, parked on the street in front of the house that never changed, was my new, well, new to me, truck. It was a faded red color with big, rounded fenders and a bulbous cab. To my intense surprise, I loved it. I didn't know if it would run, but I could see myself in it. Plus, it was one of those solid iron affairs that never gets damaged. The kind you see at the scene of an accident, paint unscratched, surrounded by the pieces of the foreign car it had destroyed.
Wow, Dad, I love it. Thanks.
Now, my horrific day tomorrow would be just that much less dreadful. I wouldn't be faced with the choice of either walking 2 miles in the rain to school or accepting a ride in the chief's cruiser.
I'm glad you like it, Charlie said gruffly, embarrassed again.
It took only one trip to get all my stuff upstairs. I got the west bedroom that faced out over the front yard. The room was familiar. It had belonged to me since I was born. The wooden floor, the light blue walls, the peaked ceiling, the yellowed lace curtains around the window. These were all part of my childhood. The only changes Charlie had ever made were switching the crib for a bed and adding a desk as I grew. The desk now held a secondhand computer, with the phone line for the modem stapled along the floor to the nearest phone jack. This was a stipulation from my mother, so that we could stay in touch easily. The rocking chair from my baby days was still in the corner. There was only one small bathroom at the top of the stairs, which I would have to share with Charlie. I was trying not to dwell too much on that fact. One of the best things about Charlie is he doesn't hover. He left me alone to unpack and get settled, a feat that would have been altogether impossible for my mother. It was nice to be alone, not to have to smile and look pleased, a relief to stare dejectedly out the window at the sheeting rain and let just a few tears escape. I wasn't in the mood to go on a real crying jag. I would save that for bedtime, when I would have to think about the coming morning. Forks High School had a frightening total of only 357, now 58, students. There were more than 700 people in my junior class alone back home. All of the kids here had grown up together. Their grandparents had been toddlers together. I would be the new girl from the big city, a curiosity, a freak. Maybe if I looked like a girl from Phoenix should, I could work this to my advantage. But physically, I'd never fit in anywhere. I should be tan, sporty, blonde, a volleyball player, or a cheerleader perhaps. All the things that go with living in the Valley of the Sun. Instead,
I was ivory-skinned, without even the excuse of blue eyes or red hair, despite the constant sunshine. I had always been slender, but soft somehow, obviously not an athlete. I didn't have the necessary hand-eye coordination to play sports without humiliating myself and harming both myself and anyone else who stood too close. When I finished putting my clothes in the old pine dresser, I took my bag of bathroom necessities and went to the communal bathroom to clean myself up after the day of travel. I looked at my face in the mirror as I brushed through my tangled, damp hair. Maybe it was the light, but already I looked sallower, unhealthy. My skin could be pretty. It was very clear, almost translucent looking, but it all depended on color. I had no color here. Facing my pallid reflection in the mirror, I was forced to admit that I was lying to myself. It wasn't just physically that I'd never fit in. And if I couldn't find a niche in a school with 3,000 people, what were my chances here? I didn't relate well to people my age. Maybe the truth was that I didn't relate well to people, period. Even my mother, who I was closer to than anyone else on the planet, was never in harmony with me, never on exactly the same page. Sometimes I wondered if I was seeing the same things through my eyes that the rest of the world was seeing through theirs. Maybe there was a glitch in my brain. But the cause didn't matter. All that mattered was the effect, and tomorrow would be just the beginning. I didn't sleep well that night, even after I was done crying. The constant whooshing of the rain and wind across the roof wouldn't fade into the background. I pulled the faded old quilt over my head, and later added the pillow, too. But I couldn't fall asleep until after midnight, when the rain finally settled into a quieter drizzle. Thick fog was all I could see out my window in the morning, and I could feel the claustrophobia creeping up on me. You could never see the sky here. It was like a cage. Breakfast with Charlie was a quiet event. He wished me good luck at school. I thanked him, knowing his hope was wasted. Good luck tended to avoid me. Charlie left first, off to the police station that was his wife and family. After he left, I sat at the old square oak table in one of the three unmatching chairs and examined his small kitchen, with its dark paneled walls, bright yellow cabinets, and white linoleum floor. Nothing was changed. My mother had painted the cabinets 18 years ago in an attempt to bring some sunshine into the house. Over the small fireplace in the adjoining handkerchief-sized family room was a row of pictures. First, a wedding picture of Charlie and my mom in Las Vegas. Then one of the three of us in the hospital after I was born, taken by a helpful nurse. Followed by the procession of my school pictures up to last year's. Those were embarrassing to look at. I would have to see what I could do to get Charlie to put them somewhere else, at least while I was living here. It was impossible, being in this house, not to realize that Charlie had never gotten over my mom. It made me uncomfortable. I didn't want to be too early to school, but I couldn't stay in the house anymore. I donned my jacket, which had the feel of a biohazard suit, and headed out into the rain. It was just drizzling still, not enough to soak me through immediately as I reached for the house key that was always hidden under the eaves by the door and locked up. The sloshing of my new waterproof boots was unnerving. I missed the normal crunch of gravel as I walked. I couldn't pause and admire my truck again as I wanted. I was in a hurry to get out of the misty wet that swirled around my head and clung to my hair under my hood. Inside the truck, it was nice and dry. Either Billy or Charlie had obviously cleaned it up. But the tan upholstered seat still smelled faintly of tobacco, gasoline, and peppermint. The engine started quickly, to my relief, but loudly, roaring to life and then idling at top volume. Well, a truck this old was bound to have a flaw. The antique radio worked, a plus that I hadn't expected. Finding the school wasn't difficult, though I'd never been there before. The school was, like most other things, just off the highway. It was not obvious that it was a school. Only the sign, which declared it to be the Forks High School, made me stop. It looked like a collection of matching houses, built with maroon-colored bricks. There were so many trees and shrubs, I couldn't see its size at first. Where was the feel of the institution? I wondered nostalgically. Where were the chain-link fences, the metal detectors? I parked in front of the first building, which had a small sign over the door reading, Front Office.
No one else was parked there, so I was sure it was off limits. But I decided I would get directions inside instead of circling around in the rain like an idiot. I stepped unwillingly out of the toasty truck cab and walked down a little stone path lined with dark hedges. I took a deep breath before opening the door. Inside, it was brightly lit and warmer than I'd hoped. The office was small, a little waiting area with padded folding chairs, orange-flecked commercial carpet, notices and awards cluttering the walls, a big clock ticking loudly.